This is Ship It with Justin Garrison and Autumn Nash. If you like this show, you will love the Changelog. It's software news on Mondays, deep technical interviews on Wednesdays, and on Fridays, an awesome talk show for your weekend enjoyment. Find it by searching for The Changelog wherever you get your podcasts. Ship It is brought to you by Fly.io. Launch your app in 5 minutes or less. Learn how at fly.io.
What's up, friends? I'm here with Jasmine Cassis from Sentry. They just wrapped up their launch week and they're always shipping. So, Jasmine, what do you think about Sentry's mantra of always be shipping?
So to me, Sentry always shipping is just in the spirit of iteration and constantly improving what we're doing to make developers ship with more confidence. We're always listening to our customers' needs and pain points. We're always iterating on products that we have launched. And on top of that, we are also, even if we look at things that customers haven't explicitly asked for, we are trying to innovate and provide solutions that I think would be really beneficial to help developers debug with more confidence.
I love that. So I know there's been an addition to one of the features out there that kind of exemplifies that. Can you share more?
Yes. So something that the team has been developing for a long time and is currently in open beta is our mobile replay product. So historically, replay has always been for web, but now we have brought it onto mobile, specifically Android, iOS, and React Native. So this allows our developers, no matter what stack they're using, to get video-like reproductions that actually help users see the repro steps that led to an error and also understand the user impact of an error.
Okay, Sentry is always shipping, always helping developers ship with confidence. That's what they do. Check out their launch week details in the link in the show notes. And of course, check out Session Replay's new edition, Mobile Replay, in the link in the show notes as well. And here's the best part. If you want to try Sentry, you can do so today with $100 off the team plan. Totally free for you to try out for you and your team. Use the code CHANGELOG. Go to sentry.io. Again, sentry.io.
Hello and welcome to Ship It, the podcast all about everything after Git push. I'm your host, Justin Garrison, and with me as always is Autumn Nash. How's it going, Autumn?
I'm caffeinated this time.
Caffeinated is a good call, and caffeinated for our last guest on our show.
I know. It's like sad.
It is sad. So for anyone that's listening, that we actually, I heard people that just started listening to the show. Welcome. We're glad you're here. By the way, this show is not going to continue on past the end of 2024. So a bit of news is Changelog is switching some stuff up. They want to focus on the main podcast that they have, Changelog and Friends, the news and the main Changelog podcast. Which is great. Like that's, I think Jared and Adam have a lot of good networks and I love those shows. So continue listening to them. But that did mean they had to make some tough calls about the other shows in the Changelog network right now. And that includes the Ship It Show, Go Time, JS Party, and Practical AI. Those four shows are not going to continue after 2024. We'll have the link to the blog post announcing it in the show notes here. But also, Autumn, we're starting a new show.
We couldn't give up being like nerds and talking too much on the internet. So here we are.
I mean, I love this community. We've already built the people that we've already met through the show. All the things I've learned through the show have been awesome.
Dude, I've straight made besties from the show. Me and Hazel do hood rat stuff like every
I've been
weekend.
Seeing you. Yeah, like, you're just like, go and have dinner. This is awesome.
Like, I feel like we've come too far. We have to just do it.
And the fact that we already had like 20 more awesome guests lined up for next year for Ship It's.
That I'm really excited to talk to.
Yeah. So we are going to continue the show. The new podcast in last episode, we didn't have a title. So finally we have a title and a domain for it. So we can tell people it's called Fork Around and Find Out.
I love it so much. I didn't love any of the other names. Like, whatever name we talked about, I was like, in that one, I was like, let's do it.
Yeah, there was a lot of names, and a lot of them were either just like, yeah, that's okay, or the domain was taken, or social was taken, whatever. And F-A-F-O-F-M.
If we're going to spend this much money on it, it needs to be fire.
Yeah, and that is also the other piece, is we do want to make this as sustainable as possible. And when I first emailed Jared and Adam about taking over the Ship It podcast, I didn't want to take it over. I was just like, can I help? Because I liked the show and I wanted to continue. I was like, do you want to co-host? What do you want to do? And my main thing was like, I don't have time to do all of the things required to maintain a podcast long-term. And I wanted something that could be long-term. And that is the goal for the new podcast as well. And so we do have people that we're paying to do stuff that we don't have time to do. Stuff like editing, sponsor mentorship, all that stuff. So we don't want to have like a premium tier. I don't really expect to have the listeners pay for it. I'm terrible at doing the plus plus content that we have here on Changelog, where I don't ever think about it in the middle of a conversation.
We just talk too much at the time.
Yeah. And like all the good bits, like I just leave it. Like, no, that has to stay in.
I feel like it would just make the actual podcast, you know what I mean? Like saving the good stuff just for people that are paying for it. Like,
I mean, and some of it is the good stuff. Some of it is just like the random asides, like the great conversation we had with Austin about kids and managing Jira tasks with chores and stuff like that. Like that's not necessarily like that's good content to me, but it's kind of made
it. His website is so dope.
Yeah. It's an aside. It's not something that needs to be in there, but we're just going to leave everything in for the new show. And I hope that sponsors will pay for it.
Or that time when there was a poem about like TARS.
Oh, that was amazing. Yeah, that was
like,
plus plus content. That was
heart. Like, yeah. It was baller.
Yes. If you have not listened to that episode, man, what number was that? That was so long ago now. But TARS all the way down.
10th episode or something.
Yeah. I was blown away by that. It was great. So anyway, the link will be in the show notes. By the time this episode comes out, the website should be available. I don't know that the RSS feed will be in all of the podcatchers. But it should be in most of them that aren't super slow. So look in the show notes. FAFO.FM is the website, and you can subscribe there as we go through this. But we have today our last guest. Philip Carter is a principal PM at Honeycomb. Welcome to the show, Philip.
Thanks for having me.
I feel like you're going to have to come back on, though. Like, you have to come back on the new podcast.
Oh, it's going to be great because we just get to redo all of our amazing guests and just like, hey, this is new.
So we have to be like extra ridiculous for this one. And then you have to come back. Like,
awesome. Sounds good. I'd be happy to do it.
And in the pre-show, we did determine that being a PM doesn't mean you work at night. and so it's something else beyond that. But tell us a little about your background. Like, how did you end up as a principal PM at Honeycomb? And what software are you responsible for?
Yeah, so I started my career working at Microsoft outside of college, and I joined the .NET team. And when that was pretty fortuitous, because this was like around 2015, when we had like the very first very crappy preview of cross-platform .NET that we were building, which at the time was called .NET Core. And like this very big goal of like, hey, we want .NET to move from like this Windows-focused development platform, which is fine, but like clearly not the future of software, to be like inherently cross-platform, inherently native, like when you deploy it on Linux, and like be able to be so that like you could run on Linux and deploy on Windows if you wanted to. You'd be a weirdo for doing that, but like you could. But like you could build your apps on Windows, deploy on Linux, build your apps on Mac, deploy on Linux, build your apps on Linux, deploy on Linux, like do whatever the heck you want. Work well in containers, like all of the things that we associate with like modern software development these days. Like these were all just like big bullet pointed lists of like, we need to add a green checkbox to every single one of these. And we're going to do it in like 5 years. So we did.
Is it not called .NET Core anymore?
No, it's just called .NET. And there's huge, huge branding things of like that, you know, that the Windows thing was called .NET or the .NET framework. And they're like, okay, we still have to keep calling it the .NET framework. There's actually some like legalities associated with that. But at the same time, it's like very obviously the legacy .NET. You can't call it legacy .NET because there's all these existing customers who are like, wait, it's legacy? That means it's going away. And we're like, no, it's like literally supported infinitely. Like, as like you pay absurd amounts of money money to Microsoft, of course the software is going to be supported. But like, also, if you want to run in all these new services that are lighting up in Azure or whatever, like, yeah, you're going to have to migrate, because those things are not just like Windows boxes run in the cloud. Like, these are Linux hosts. These are, you know, the whole world of like cloud development is like clearly not Windows focused. And so, huge journey. So I worked on our languages, specifically on the F# language and the C# compiler quite a bit, and then IDE tooling in Visual Studio. So, and also our family of like Visual Studio Code, and like there were other cross-platform language server type stuff. And this is, keep in mind, also when the concept of a language server was still being actively developed.
At this point, were you an engineer or were you a PM?
I was a PM, but PM was kind of weird in that group. We wrote a lot of code. We did a lot of prototypes. It was not uncommon for PMs to actually just implement entire features or like do the initial architecture for something, because we needed someone to like not be tied to the current shipping schedule and just go and explore, see what we can do.
Yeah,
that's the kind of PM I'm trying to worm my way into being.
Yeah.
So someone that's outside the sprint cadence. You're like, nah, I can do whatever I want.
I was like, can I contribute upstream? And they're like, if you want. And I was like,
that's when the night job kicks in. That's yeah.
I do really recommend it. I mean, I think like as an aside, in terms of like product work, there's a lot of literature about how to be a good PM and how to do good product work and stuff like that. And I think a lot of it ends up getting over-indexed on, and a lot more time gets spent on things like product discovery when you just kind of have your hands in all the things at all times, and like you're constantly interacting with your users and all of that, like you can spend shockingly less time on like so-called PM work and still have like a pretty clear set of goals and then develop just a lot more empathy, especially in developer tools. Like your users are writing code, they're doing, you know, XYZ stuff. And it's like somewhat of a sometimes controversial thing to say, like, hey, you should do that too as a PM, because that's just the reality that your users are living. And what better way to understand their problems than to literally experience some of their problems yourself and be like, wow, this sucks. Maybe we should like fix this.
That's why I feel like I want to stay like as technical as possible in using the products that I'm a PM for, because I don't want to lose the empathy for developers, you know?
Intuition is way better than data.
Yeah.
Right. Like if you're like data driven, you're like, no, I know how this should work because I do it, is like so much more powerful than saying like, here's why and I will show you why.
I'm not going to lie, but I'm so excited to write code for fun and for an experiment and not in production.
Like, nice.
I'm back.
Like, not being on call is a magical experience. Philip, so like out of college doing this PM, like PM work is usually like more of a leadership type role for like a pretty big sort of migration progress. Like, again, making legacy makes money, right? Like that's the, like now you're like, oh, that legacy thing makes a ton of money and we need to make it make new money. It's like a big responsibility straight out of college.
It is. And this is, I think, one of the places where I think Microsoft, or at least certainly Microsoft in the era that I was there, is really a great place for growing PMs, because they do throw you into the deep end. But then they also treat you like someone who is capable of swimming in the deep end.
Right.
And so like occasionally someone, you know, it's not the right role for them, or like, you know, they, frankly, it was like a little too much or something like that. But like the majority of people who I worked with, they're like fully intellectually capable of like handling all of those kinds of things. And there's obviously like a learning curve and a pretty good like structure to make sure that, you know, you don't make a horrifying mistake, but it's a great way to learn really quickly. And I found that since I switched over to Honeycomb into the startup world, there's this like meme about like people in big tech can't work in startups because they're too used to like too much structure and too much stuff around them and yada, yada, yada. And I'm like, no, we were like feral children left to like just try to make these things work with users in the millions. And like the concept that we have users in the dozens right now for this thing is like not necessarily easy mode, but like easier in some ways and like harder in some other ways.
The small scale impact is amazing at it. Like this is my first startup too. And coming from Amazon, where it felt like the PM group was also thrown into the deep end, but at some point, like Amazon was kind of putting their foot on your head and you're kind of like, wait a minute, I'm trying to swim here. Like, what's going on? And then at a startup, it was just like, oh, I have all the same responsibilities, but I have none of the process overhead of like, oh, I have to go talk to 18 people before I can do that one thing that I know is the next thing I have to do.
I'm really excited to be working as a PM for Linux at Microsoft, because in the insecurity realm, because it's so new to Microsoft that it's got that startup vibe. which was very much key spaces at Amazon. And like, you have get to do all the things and try all the things, but like under the shell of corporate America.
Yeah. I mean, security is really new for Microsoft.
I knew you were going to throw shade at me. Why are you like this? Like, also, I've decided Philip is like our people, because did you see him give his whole background with like just a little bit of honesty and truth and shade, but then also like you, we're right here.
You can have a good experience and have some shade. It's fine.
You can. Absolutely.
But it's being honest and people being able to trust your opinion.
And your experience is your experience and no one can take that away.
Yeah. Because, but when people aren't honest and they'll just say all the good things and they'll just like blow smoke up like at you, you won't trust them and their opinion on anything technical. Like that's how you lose all your credibility, you know?
What's up, friends? I'm here with Kurt Mackey, co-founder and CEO of Fly. As you know, we love Fly. That is the home of changelog.com. But Kurt, I want to know how you explain Fly to developers. Do you tell them a story first? How do you do it?
I kind of change how I explain it based on almost like the generation of developer I'm talking to. So like for me, I built and shipped apps on Heroku, which if you've never used Heroku is roughly like building and shipping an app on Vercel today. It's just, it's 2024 instead of 2008 or whatever. And what frustrated me about doing that was I got stuck. You can build and ship a Rails app with a Postgres on Heroku, the same way you can build and ship a Next.js app on Vercel. But as soon as you want to do something interesting, like as soon as you want to, at the time, I think one of the things I ran into is like, I wanted to add what used to be like kind of the basis for Elasticsearch. I want to do full text search in my applications. You kind of hit this wall with something like Heroku where you can't really do that. I think lately we've seen it with like people wanting to add LLMs kind of inference stuff to their applications on Vercel or Heroku or Cloudflare or whoever these days. They've started like releasing abstractions that sort of let you do this, but I can't just run the model I'd run locally on these black box platforms that are very specialized. For the people my age, it's always like, oh, Heroku was great, but I outgrew it. And one of the things that I felt like I should be able to do when I was using Heroku was like run my app close to people in Tokyo for users that were in Tokyo. And that was never possible. For modern generation devs, it's a lot more Vercel based. It's a lot like Vercel is great right up until you hit one of their hard line boundaries. And then you're kind of stuck. There's the other one. We've had someone within the company, I can't remember the name of this game, but the tagline was like 5 minutes to start, forever to master. It's sort of how we're pitching Fly. It's like you can get an app going in 5 minutes, but there's so much depth to the platform that you're never going to run out of things you can do with it.
So unlike AWS or Heroku or Vercel, which are all great platforms, the cool thing we love here at Changelog most about Fly is that no matter what we want to do on the platform, we have primitives, we have abilities, and we as developers can charge our own mission on Fly. It is a no limits platform built for developers, and we think you should try it out. Go to fly.io to learn more. Launch your app in 5 minutes. Too easy. Once again, fly.io.
All right, Philip, here's one honest thing that I have wanted to know for a very long time.
Oh, no.
There was a .NET fork called Mono or Mono, right? It was .NET that was like, it was its own open source thing. How was that treated inside of Microsoft being on this .NET team that was trying to get there? And they were like going from the other side, like we made this .NET native thing on Linux. Was that like, don't ever talk about it? Was that like, we are going to beat them and consume all their stuff? How was that treated?
Surprisingly pretty well. So at the time, Miguel, he's now a good friend. Shout out to Miguel. You should talk to him sometime. He's amazing. He was the lead of the Mono project. He founded it when it started and then helped create Xamarin with Nat, who you know has since kind of came like CEO of GitHub and all that. But like they were very much set out to focusing their runtime on making it work as well on client libraries as much as they could. Like once mobile hit, Miguel was attached to it and he's like, I love this form factor, but I want to use C#. That's just the way it's going to be. And when you make a lot of optimizations for a mobile form factor, which is great, unfortunately, that can often come at the expense of really good performance server side, for just like the constraints are just fundamentally different. Like, you know, when you have like a backend service where GC pressure really matters, when you have a couple million requests per second or something like that, it's just fundamental behavior of the garbage collector that needs to, you know, work a certain way compared to how you would want it to work in like a battery constrained device doing certain things. Obviously, lots of similarities. Like, there's elements of systems programming going on here where, like, you know, there's good code written in both places. But like, when you would try, very often when you would try to host a mono service somewhere, it would just fall over and you'd be like, oh, well, is this a joke? It's like, no, it's not actually. It was just made for something completely different. And so we had this kind of complex relationship where, this is before the acquisition of Xamarin, where we were building our own thing and targeting the backend with ASP.NET apps and saying, okay, we want to make this like, you know, a Go developer should be able to pick up our stack and be like, oh, great, this has the same perf that I care about. That was sort of like the target that we were going for. But on the Xamarin client side, we're like, okay, this is just a fundamentally different runtime and actually even different like set of libraries. And then we worked with them to start unifying some of the library layer, because there's just all the different utilities in the .NET standard library that like, it really don't matter where it runs, but like, they had their own version of this and we had our own version of this. And we're like, okay, this is like, regardless of like what degree we work together on, we all agree this should just be a standard that we all consume. And who owns the code, like, we'll figure that out. It's an open source project all around anyways. And so there was actually a lot of collaboration on that side of things. And then eventually, you know, strategically, I think they were probably aiming for this at some point. You know, we acquired Xamarin, at which point we were able to unify significantly more. And then we actually were able to go on a very big technical project where we unified the runtimes entirely. And we're able to actually do that quite successfully, to the point where it's actually the same singular runtime that can run on a client device or on the backend. And they have excellent performance characteristics. And it's actually like different parts of the runtime will sort of like activate depending on like the deployment environment. And like the garbage collector has like 5 or 6 different modes that it can sort of operate under. And like, it'll have like different behaviors depending on like the kind of thing that it's sort of like packaged into and stuff. And this is all something that was like architected and designed for. It was pretty wild.
Do you know if other languages do that? Is that like something that's common?
I know that like in Java, they do that because they have many different runtimes for different purposes. However, you do need to, like, it's sort of, the burden is on the developer to deploy the appropriate runtime for their thing. Whereas in .NET, we architected it. So like, it's just one thing that you deploy to like whatever device or server or what have you, and like the right things activate in the right way.
It also has to do with a lot of the garbage collectors. There's different garbage collectors and you need to tune them in different manners depending on what you're doing. So it's possible, but it's not as easy. Like, you need to know what you're doing, or you need someone to know what they're doing, or to do the research and do the paint. But once you get it running, it's very, very effective. And the new changes they've made to the garbage collectors and like Shenandoah and all the different like projects make it very, very effective. Java's gotten progressively faster in the last couple of runtimes. So they've done a lot of really good work, and a lot of like the profilers and things to get the information, like the new projects that are coming out, or have made a lot of advances in such a legacy technology.
Oh yeah. Like Java, it's an impressive engineering system that they have, that they built with just all these really smart people there. And like, obviously like the language side is also evolving with all these like great features and stuff, but like, kind of to your point, Java's like low key really good with perf. And like, I think there's this association a lot of developers still have with like, oh, Java is like slow or whatever. And it's like, well, yeah, in 2005.
Well, not just that, but Lilliput and just a lot of the things that are like coming out that are like, usually as it gets older, it gets kind of like people are just maintaining it. But the things that have moved forward in the last couple of years in Java are really impressive to be at this stage in technology, to be like just making it so much more efficient. And to be able to bridge the gap, I don't think we're ever going to get to the point where it acts like it's something that doesn't need to be compiled, but the gains that we've made in the last couple of years are so impressive that it's getting competitive, you know, if you don't want to write in C++ or you don't want to have to worry about that.
I remember at Amazon, because it's like the problem with Java is like no one ever upgrades their Java, right? It's just like, oh, well, the perf problems of 2005.
Oh, don't, you're going to give me PTSD. Stop.
Are still, because people are still running it from 2005, right? Like, I'm still on Java 9 or something like that. But I remember at Amazon, they had this whole like shim layer that they built in. And I'm pretty sure there was a blog post about this where they're like, well, we're not going to rewrite all our Java, but we are going to compile onto the new virtual environment for like where the actual runtime, the compiled VM runs, and they save like millions and millions of dollars because they're like, we just got better performance.
The performance literally paid for like millions of dollars.
All the engineering time plus more. Yeah. It was crazy. Just like, we just put a shim. We didn't rewrite the code. We recompiled it, put the shim.
During the pandemic, when they were firing other people, our department kept growing because that's how much money optimized. Like, it got to the point where they wanted to rewrite everything in Rust, but Java got so much faster that they could prioritize what they wanted to write in Rust. And Amazon does a lot of things wrong in open source, but the way the Credo team is built and how they maintain and they contribute up open source, like upstream, is just phenomenal. They hired a lot of very smart people to do a lot of amazing things. And I love that it's contributed back and it's not just taken for Amazon. Like, I think if they ever do anything well, they did it for that team.
So fast forward a little bit here. Let's get out of the .NET era and at Honeycomb.
That's baller though, because .NET was like, you know what I mean? Like, to do that all on one runtime, like, I feel like you said it, but like, you didn't say how, like, that is amazing to run mobile and for it to be able to do the decision, or not decision making, but like to do the change for you to know how to like run on that.
Build that into the language. Yeah. Yes. Don't make it hard for the developers.
Like, that is just like, I don't feel like you gave yourself enough credit in that statement. Like, that is impressive.
Well, it was hard work of a lot of people. But yeah, I think like we had some pretty ambitious goals and we kind of nailed them. And I'm really proud of that.
Yeah, you just talked about it. Like, you just like made the soup of the day. Like, you're doing engineering magic over here. Like, what do you mean?
And then you leave Microsoft and you're over at Honeycomb now. You went straight from Microsoft to Honeycomb?
Yeah. So it was kind of funny because after we basically, like, one of our major success metrics was like, well, how many users are using the new .NET? We reached about 5 million. And that was sort of like a major benchmark and we hit it. And I had just had a conversation with my PM director and I asked him like, so what's the next like big thing? I mean, this was really ambitious and like we knocked it out of the park. What's the next big one? And he's like, I don't know. And that was because he was switching jobs over into another department, offered a VP position at Microsoft. I'm like, oh, that's why you don't know. Okay. Well, I guess maybe I'll look around too, because, you know, I really liked the team that I was on, but you know, you complete an ambitious like arc and you're like, okay, well, let's kind of look around what's out there. Maybe there's something new. There's clearly a lot of interesting stuff going on in developer tools outside of programming languages. So like looking up stack, what are the things that are there? So I ended up talking with some folks at Honeycomb just because I didn't know anything about observability at all. But I was aware of Liz and Charity, and I was aware of like a general consensus among some of the .NET developers that I knew that Honeycomb was like doing things like the right way or the better way or whatever. And I'm like, okay, cool. Like, let's explore. What's the worst that can happen? Like, it's not for me. All right, cool. So chatted with them, kind of did the whole interview loop, really liked the people, and was kind of sold on some of the initial vision, because Honeycomb, as like, it came out before OpenTelemetry, but it was still very, very early stages, like when OpenTelemetry was formed. And Honeycomb as an observability tool, it is fundamentally different from the rest on the market. Kind of like has this ambitious goal of like, we really want to help developers reshape like fundamentally the way that they introspect their systems. And like this gets from like super high level, like how you do an analysis workflow. You know, instead of saying like, oh, I'm going to look at my logs and then I'm going to go look at traces that correspond to that and see if I can find like a match and like, oh, I have this metric that says it's up. All right, cool. Are there any logs that relate to like this time range or something? Kind of a broken debugging flow compared to what we sort of do. And that kind of attracted me. But then at the same time, they're like, well, there's also this whole other thing with OpenTelemetry where regardless of like our product shape or what we think people should be doing best, there's this open standard that's evolving that is ambitious enough that like people, it captures the majority of what people care about. And we have some pretty big customers who are like, them continuing with the Honeycomb is pretty contingent on us being like quite deeply involved in the project. So like one of our larger customers, what quite literally in like clear contract terms was like, you need to be significantly involved here, because we're taking a bet on standardizing on OTel and we're taking a bet on using Honeycomb across all of our teams. And I do not want like one of those pillars to like falter in some way. So like, I trust that you care about your business, but do you really care about OTel? Figure it out. That's sort of what the role was scoped to. was, okay, we're going to take a bet on OTEL. Great, we did it. Mission accomplished. But what is that bet? What are we doing, though? Where should we point our time and, you know, our limited number of engineers who we have? Should we hire for this? For how many? What are the most important things to invest in? What are the major problems that people have? Like, all the big stuff. And I was just given the mandate to go and shape that into, like, where do we point the vector of, you know, our force vector, if you will? And how do we keep doing that? And then how do we start, like, A, trying to start skating where the puck is going, of like, the project is evolving in this way. Can we make sure, at least at a very minimum, does the Honeycomb product not, like, get destroyed by this thing in some way? We don't want to be caught by surprise in some capacity. But then also B, okay, well, we do have a perspective here. How much of our perspective on observability aligns with the overall perspective of OpenTelemetry? How do we make these things come together in a way that fits very well and works for everyone involved? And how do we ultimately demonstrate that we are leaders in the project instead of just consumers of this open standard? That was sort of like the main thing. And that's what I did for about 3 years or so. And, you know, being a startup, I kind of had my hands in all kinds of different places, but it was always very fundamentally rooted in being an OpenTelemetry maintainer, which I've been since, I think like the end of 2021, and like trying to fix all kinds of problems that, like, oh, someone's trying to use OpenTelemetry plus Honeycomb, plus this language, plus this environment that they want to run in. It falls over in this way. Okay, great. Like, is that a legitimate bug? Is that a documentation problem? Is that, like, they wanted to use an API in this way and they couldn't figure it out? And, like, we need to add a more convenience API to something, just make it, like, more obvious for someone how they accomplish something. Just multitudes of that kind of work over the course of the years, and just being much more involved in the project and trying to shape, like, you know, what are the things that we try to make good in this big open standard that, you know, none of us have the time to, like, really work 100% on all the time. And I don't know, kind of lengthy stuff, but did that. Still doing that, frankly.
You guys can't see it, but Philip made the best face. Like, it made my whole life.
So in fall of 2022, or like late summer of 2022, I'd sufficiently been at Honeycomb long enough that I kind of got the whole breadth of, like, what does the customer journey look like? What are people struggling with, like, when they onboard versus when they're, like, on day 500 of using the product, and what are their struggles when they're trying to onboard other teams in their organization? Because, like, you know, this one group buys Honeycomb and they have an awesome time, but, like, that doesn't necessarily mean that this other engineering team that they work with is also going to have a great time, and, like, their challenges might be slightly different. And I came to the conclusion that our product has all of these things that people want to do, where, like, the answer lies on some probabilistic distribution. Like, a very concrete example that ultimately turned in one of the features that I helped build was, people come in saying, hey, I want to query something in this way. Like, I care about this information. Well, there's, like, possibly hundreds of queries that could technically work for what you're trying to do. And there's, like, no single one that's guaranteed to be the right one. Like, if you say slow requests, okay, well, there is a way to technically measure that. But, like, then you get into, okay, we have all these different aggregators. Do you care about an average? You care about a P80, a P90, a P95? Like, do you not actually care about any kind of aggregation? You just want to see a count of some kind? You care about, like, a max, and you want to see, like, the maximums? And then when you say, okay, slow request, but with respect to what? Is it with respect to, like, a particular call to an HTTP route or a call to a database? If you have multiple database, like, there's so many different ways to potentially answer this in terms of a query. And, like, nothing in our product was like, hey, here's how you do that. It just all sort of assumed that you knew how to shape what you cared about in the right form and the right kind of query to sort of do that. And this is just something that, like, I mean, frankly, is still a problem with Honeycomb. And the natural language querying thing that we built in early 2023 is, like, just a step in the direction of helping people there. But I kind of wrote this document that was like, hey, there's all these areas in the product where, like, the solution lies on some probabilistic distribution. And there are, like, parts of that distribution that are likely to be more useful than other parts. And that is squarely the domain of machine learning. So, like, we should investigate, we should explore, we should experiment, we should try stuff, ship to learn, see what happens, fork around and find out.
We gotta keep Philip forever. Like, he has to come back. Like, he is our people.
Okay, friends, I'm with a good friend of mine, Avtar Suwathin from Timescale. They are positioning Postgres for everything from IoT, sensors, AI, dev tools, crypto, and finance apps. So Avtar, help me understand why Timescale feels Postgres is most well-positioned to be the database for AI applications.
It's the most popular database according to the Stack Overflow developer survey. And Postgres, one of the distinguishing characteristics is that it's extensible. And so you can extend it for use cases beyond just relational and transactional data for use cases like time series and analytics. That's kind of where Timescale, the company, started, as well as now more recently, vector search and vector storage, which are super impactful for applications like RAG, recommendation systems, and even AI agents, which we're seeing, you know, more and more of those things today.
Yeah, Postgres is super powerful. It's well-loved by developers. I feel like more devs, because they know it, it can enable more developers to become AI developers, AI engineers, and build AI apps.
From our side, we think Postgres is really the no-brainer choice. You don't have to manage a different database. You don't have to deal with data synchronization and data isolation because you have like three different systems and three different sources of truth. And one area where we've done work in is around the performance and scalability. So we've built an extension called PG Vector Scale that enhances the performance and scalability of Postgres so that you can use it with confidence for large-scale AI applications like RAG and agents and such. And then also another area is, coming back to something that you said, enabling more and more developers to make the jump into building AI applications and become AI engineers using the expertise that they already have. And so that's where we built the PG AI extension that brings LLMs to Postgres to enable things like LLM reasoning on your Postgres data, as well as embedding creation. And for all those reasons, I think, you know, when you're building an AI application, you don't have to use something new. You can just use Postgres.
Well, friends, learn how Timescale is making Postgres powerful. Over 3 million Timescale databases power IoT, sensors, AI, dev tools, crypto, and finance applications, and they do it all on Postgres. Timescale uses Postgres for everything, and now you can too. Learn more at timescale.com. Again, timescale.com.
So, did Honeycomb create OpenTelemetry, or was it like an open source project that they ended up adapting, or did they start it as an open source product? Was it started as an actual product for Honeycomb that wasn't open source and then it was open sourced? How did all that come about?
Yeah, OpenTelemetry was founded by several folks. I don't remember if Liz was on the founding group or not. I don't think she was, but she was part of the initial governance committee. But so basically, there were several open source projects like OpenTracing, OpenCensus, Jaeger, Zipkin, all solving various flavors of the same problem, but like not quite completely enough to the point where there needed to be another project spun up to do something in a slightly better way. And so people who worked on all of these things, and also other folks like who work at Splunk, or like at the time, I think Morgan was like at Google and stuff, but several of these folks, and they all got together and they're like, hey, we're all like solving like anywhere from 50 to 75% of the problem space that we need to be solving for. And we're all doing it independently. Let's all get together and go to 100% of the problem space that we need to solve for together as one standard, because a million different standards that are slightly incomplete for certain use cases that people have is like, we're not going to grow. And, you know, the world of proprietary instrumentations from all the other vendors is just going to stay there. And then like that has its own set of negative consequences that like organizations actually do not like. But like, we're not meeting them where they are. So like, let's get together and do that. It was this consortium in about 2019 where they did this.
I love that you got that many engineers and people good at things to like, it's like a, like for them to say, okay, our projects maybe need some improvement and we should work together. Like, you got people that are engineers in a room to say that out loud. And to, like,
watching this all happen from the outside, right? Like at the time, like I was just an observer of like, why do they keep changing the names on all these things? Because OpenTel came from something else that was open something. I don't remember what it was. But like, I remember watching Jaeger and all those things that were like all these like little projects spinning out of big companies. And they all were like doing bits and pieces here and there. And then like, it all just kind of like got together and the companies didn't want it. It didn't seem right. Like, all the companies were like, this is actually how we make money. Our instrumentation, like the Splunk instrumentation in your app, is what makes Splunk sticky. And if we can make that sticky, then we have a competitive advantage. And then once we're like, oh, we can just democratize all of that collecting, because at the end of the day, like it's all basically the same kind of stuff in just a new flavor, a new API. And some of them didn't have support for different languages. So we're like, oh yeah, if you want Scala, you got to go over to this one. And if you want Go, you have to go to this one. And it was like this huge thing. Like, why don't we just collect all of that stuff? And so from the outside, it was interesting just watching it all kind of collapse into this. Oh, one group is going to have all of the, at first I thought it was just tracing, right? Open tracing. It was like the big thing. We're like, we're going to get all the languages together and we're just going to do the instrumentation. And then it was like, oh, well, we're also going to do the metrics. Oh, we're also going to do the logs. Oh, we're also going to do it. I was like, oh, now it's like a full stack thing of what was going on. And every time I'd listen to Charity or Liz talk, like, it doesn't matter what the data is. You have to be able to like look at it. You have to be able to understand what's going on. And the difference between collecting data and understanding the system are two different problems, which I think is fascinating what you're calling out here, where it's like, I can't just have all of the data in the world and all of a sudden understand, oh, this is where the problem is. Like, no, you have to know where to look. And someone, like you mentioned, like someone has to help you get there. And there are probabilities in those systems.
Not just that, but you need to be able to get the bigger picture of the data. Like, people collect data all the time and they have no idea what to do with all those logs and what to do. Like, it just,
well, yeah, you just keep zooming out, right? Because yeah, that's what, like, when you have a log, you're like, oh, I'm going to print here in my code. I'm like, oh, I found the piece, right? Like, I'm terrible at GDB, so I'm just going to do this one print and I find it. But like, once you zoom out to like, oh, that was 10 things calling it. Okay, how do those things call? Is this network related? Is this DNS? It's always DNS. And then just keep zooming out. You're like, okay, now how's the application? What does the customer experience look like? Like, Honeycomb seems like they always approached it from that side of it. It was like, if you're, what's Charity's line? If your uptime doesn't matter if your customer has a bad day or something like that. Like, if your customer's angry, then it, all the uptime in the world doesn't matter. And so being able to just go back to those basics, but as an engineer, where do I look? How do I look there? How did you start building that ML, AI infrastructure stuff to get people in, to nudge them in the right direction?
Yeah, so we approached this from a couple different ways. I was lucky enough to be able to go to several different conferences and work with our sales engineers on just like doing demos for people and seeing what's like the ideal story that we tell people. And I got to do all these demos and stumble through them and eventually sort of get my own storytelling craft down with respect to, you know, like poking around with like what these people care about and then trying to like map that to like, okay, you know, well, we have this system. So I'm going to show you this system. It's like this e-commerce site. And like, you know, I could show you some metrics showing like uptime or memory use of pods or something like that. But that doesn't tell me anything about the business problems that this set of services solve, right? There are real users. There are like the concept of like a shopping cart, and some users fill the shopping cart with more things than other users. And like, there are certain aspects of latency or reliability, errors, what have you, that matter more in some contexts than other some contexts. So like, of course, it's important when you have low latency. You should have low latency all the time. Yes. We all agree. But it's especially important if someone presses the checkout button when they've like added a bunch of stuff to their cart, that thing had better not be slow and it had better not have an error. And like, you know, real systems being as complicated as they are, there's always going to be slowness and errors inherent in everything. But like, some things matter a lot more than others. And can you track that kind of stuff in a way systematically such that you can start with a high level view and then always start from like a high level entry point that is a combination of broad, but yet also opinionated enough that allows you to narrow down toward a particular characteristic that does not require you to know upfront where you need to start narrowing down on. That's kind of the fundamental thing. Like, you know, imagine you're a new engineer brought into this e-commerce site. You don't know how any of this stuff works, but you have to fix a bug because you got paged and you're now on call. Do you want to be in a situation where you have to know the exact like lines of code that you should be watching out for? Well, no, that sucks. That's going to take forever. You're not going to be able to solve that. Or can you start with like a high level? Okay, well, let's say we do start from this notion of slow requests, but it's based on like endpoints. Okay, I can narrow that down to like, there's this one endpoint that's like weirder than the other. That's probably a breadcrumb to sort of go and follow. I'll go with that. Okay, well, like what's interesting about like a full distribution of latencies about this? Oh, I see there's like this weird little spike going on right here. I wonder what that could mean. Using like the Honeycomb tool, we have this anomaly detection thing where you can like, it's called bubble up, but I think now we're, at any rate, you do this thing called a bubble up and you can sort of like visually select this like part of a graph that looks a little different than the others. And then it'll just automatically compare all of the events sort of in the selection versus what's not in the selection and splay out via like literally like histograms, all the values of each of those events and all the values that correspond to all the columns in each of those events and sort them in a way that you can say, oh, well, there's these like five columns and these like handful of values that associate with these columns in my data that are actually the characteristics that associate most with this spike in latency that I see here. But I didn't have to know up front that, like, oh, there's this one attribute in my data that is the thing that I should be looking at. And it's this sort of generalizable thing. It's this thing that, like, works. Like, when people watch this flow, they're like, wow, this is how I actually do want to be debugging. Because when I get onboarded onto a thing, I don't get onboarded onto what every line of code does first. I get onboarded onto, like, what is the purpose of this thing? What should it be doing? What matters the most to our business? And, like, this is how, like, I mean, frankly, most organizations should probably be working anyways.
It is, and they're not. Yes.
Yeah, there's a whole other thing there. But this whole flow that I'm talking about, A, it's a little bit fuzzy. B, it's a little bit probabilistic. C, sometimes you get into a dead end, you got to back out. It's like, you know, you're not always going to be 100% right every time, but it's fine, right? Like, you're exploring, you're debugging.
You're also still learning about the process while doing that, though. So it's not valuable time wasted.
Right, exactly. In the course of doing that, there's sort of these, like, ever more slightly opinionated and narrow views of the world that you get as you sort of go through the next step. And so we said, okay, what are ways that we can start replicating that in a way to get people past, you know, empty page, what do I start with? How do we get them onto a track where it's easier for them to start narrowing in on this particular kind of debugging? And that manifested as, like, okay, well, when we talk with a bunch of people, they can very often express what they want to start looking at. They can just say the words, well, I care about slow requests in my system. Awesome. Cool. Like, what is a good query for slow requests in your system? Well, it depends on your data. Oh, crap. Okay. Well, we can't, like, literally give you the single query for that. However, an ML model can look at the shape of your data and your schema and have some examples of other shapes of data and other schemas and say, well, in those shapes, slow requests can mean this kind of query. Given this shape that is, like, kind of similar to these other shapes that I have in my example set, well, I can create a query that is probably going to show you something kind of like that. And so, like, there's degrees to this where, like, it can actually work very, very well, especially if you're using OpenTelemetry and there's a lot of, like, common names for certain kinds of operations. But we found that GPT 3.5 back in 2023 did a shockingly good job of being able to say, like, okay, well, if I have this, like, named pair of, I have a natural language query, I have a natural language query. I have a list of columns that are considered relevant for this natural language query. And I have a query shape, which is like a JSON object that follows a particular schema. And basically said, like, these three things, like, that query shape matches the two other things that you have there. It can then look at your column names and say, oh, well, you measure latency with a slightly different name for a column, but, like, the name of it implies something to do with latency. And so that's probably a good candidate that we can pull in as context. And then just through, like, basic few shot example prompting, you can actually just sort of trick GPT 3.5 into saying, oh, well, my job is to output a JSON object that fits this particular schema. And in the system prompt, there's, like, some rules about, like, what makes for the right JSON object and stuff. This was something that, like, I experimented with in April of 2023. And in the course of doing that experimentation, I found, wow, this thing actually does output really good stuff. And I know that there's going to be a very long tail of, like, it might not get something quite right, but, like, this shifted from, is this even possible, to, oh, this is definitely possible. And this is probably also going to be useful for several people out of the box already. But, like, what can we do to make it really useful to as many people as possible? And that's kind of, like, where my mindset shifted. And that's how the thing ultimately started into building our natural language querying system.
You know what I think is really impressive about everything that you've said? First, the fact that you actually went to the conferences and listened to your customers, like, the feedback loop of, like, customers, and especially, like, people go to conferences with their competition and don't do, like, I, like, love going to the different, like, booths and talking to their engineers and talking to their PMs, and the disconnect between their engineers, their PMs, and their customers is wild. And then they never have the right information about the competitors that are 10 feet away from them, and they could have easily went to the, like, booth and asked a question, and it blows my entire mind every time. Like, that is the best part about being a solutions architect or PM or whatever you want to call it, just being able to compare the product and see, like, where, like, half the time there's low-hanging fruit that would be so easy to fix or to, like, know more about to make your products better. But also, like, you're using AI for something that's going to actually make people's lives better, not something that we didn't ask for. Not in a way that you're handicapping your developers. Like, a lot of times, like, just adding to, like, IDEs, you're teaching new developers, like, bad habits that they don't even know they're getting, and you're not enabling them to get the skills that they need to troubleshoot and to grow as engineers, right? But you're using it in a way that actually teaches you how to debug and what the process is and to help them learn processes, which makes engineers better. So, like, I think, like, I'm so excited about this. I want to go play with it because, like, I think we're going to handicap so many engineers, like, in this next generation with different AI because they are only, like, it's like that one meme and it's like, why hire a software engineer if they just Google? Like, why give them six figures to just Google? And that's because you know what to Google. You know what I mean? And we're almost taking that from people because ChatGPTs or just any GPT is going to become the source of truth and they're not going to get the, like, the skills to figure out, like, this looks wrong or this looks right. Or because so much of it isn't just an error in IDE. That's not all of being an engineer and putting all these pieces together. So, like, the way that you're describing it is so exciting because you're teaching them a process. Even if they're going down the wrong, like, you're, for one, making it faster, which we all know that people, like, every, like, big company or a small company needs you to get faster from being new, onboarding, and writing that first commit in PR, right? But also, like, they need you to be effective and to learn. And you're bridging those two things, which is just amazing. Like, that's, this is the first time I've been so excited about AI because usually I'm like, oh, this sounds bad. Like, you know? That's actually, like, amazing.
Yeah, yeah. And that was definitely the goal. And, like, we have much more ambitious goals around this thing as well, around, like, that we have gotten feedback from people where, like, they do want to drive their querying process end to end using natural language. And you can kind of use Query Assistant to do that today. It's not as good at that. And frankly, that's just, that was a scoping exercise because the primary problem that we were seeking to solve right then and there, which frankly, I think was the right problem, is a lot of people would come in, try to use Honeycomb, but they'd see our interface and they'd be like, I just don't understand how I can start to use this. Like, I can express how I would like to start out, but I don't know how to shape that in a Honeycomb query. And we found pretty good success metrics where, like, people would come in, they would use the natural language query feature a few times, sometimes quite a lot actually, and then they would start using our manual querying interface to, like, manually tweak things and explore a little bit more without even using the natural language portion of it. Sometimes they would, and it does support that, but sometimes they wouldn't. And from our perspective, we're like, great, we don't really care if you're using the AI feature or the non-AI feature. We want you to explore your data. And if this helped you get to the point where you could start exploring more and get more curious, like, great, that's the problem that we're solving.
This is the biggest value prop that I hear you saying out of everything, is that you're making them more efficient, but you're, like, so it's like alarm fatigue, right? Like, you're going to start to ignore your alarms if they're always going off. And, like, log, when you get so much log data that it's so much that you just need to delete it because you don't know where to start and it's filling up all your disk space, or, you know what I mean? But what you're doing right now is you're helping them to focus and to break down a problem. And that's kind of all of what engineering is, right? You take these big problems, these big systems, especially at scale, right? And you break down the problem so you can learn, like, I feel like we always talk about observability and metrics, but it's so hard to get the good metrics and figure out what you should be paying attention to and figuring out how your system works, whether you're new or you're just, maybe one of your coworkers built something and now you have to go fix it, you know, or somebody leaves. Like, especially with all the turnover in tech right now, we are going to have these huge systems at scale that you might not have built. Like, in college, you sit there and you build these projects from scratch, but that's not being an engineer in real life, right? Like, you're going and you're going to go work in a legacy, like, code base that's huge that you do not have the time to figure out. You're going to have to just get thrown in there. And what you're doing is you're making them efficient and you're giving them this whole process. And I just think that that is, like, a huge value prop of why your product is valuable, you know? And in this time where people are really having to make those hard decisions to figure out where to budget and where to put their money, something that's going to help your engineers grow and help them to be more efficient with their time, but also not handicapping them, is just, like, fire.
Yeah, yeah. And we think that that's a good use for this kind of technology right now. I mean, you know, there's a bunch of AI hype nonsense, whatever. I barely even pay attention to it anymore.
But it's wild because you're actually in AI, but like a lot of people in AI will just be like hyping it and you're like, none of this makes sense. But you're like, goes back to what I said in the beginning of the podcast. Like you have enough honesty that you keep it real, that it makes me trust your opinion. You know what I mean? But also your product actually genuinely sounds cool.
Yeah. That, I mean, frankly, that's what we're aiming for. People don't want to be replaced. They don't want things to be wholly replaced. Like the people are willing to accept change. They're willing to accept, hey, this thing that I might've liked doing in the past is now getting abstracted over. There's like an engine that can do some of that. Like, I think we've seen variations of that throughout history. I imagine there were probably some developers out there who really loved handwriting assembly. And I think the majority of them have probably also come to accept that compilers are pretty great and we can use compilers so we don't have to handwrite assembly all the time. But like,
it's like people who love to write bash by hand for no reason, just to like be mean to themselves.
Yeah, I will say, as far as I am so happy that I barely have to write any bash in my life. I can just go to ChatGPT and it does a good enough job. And I'm like, thank you. Same thing with regexes. I find zero joy in that. I am so happy to offload that.
I have like two friends who just, they get great joy out of writing regex. And I'm like, I love you smart people, but I want nothing to do like at all.
Power to them.
This shows that this product will outlive the AI hype. This is like something worth investing in. And, you know, like there's always that turnaround cycle of, ooh, this new thing is cool. And then you onboard to it and then you have to migrate off of it and you're just stuck in this tech debt cycle. And I feel like this is like the value prop of like why your product is worth giving the try to, worth investing in. And it's going to outlive this because it actually delivers value to engineers, and it's not just a hype thing. It very much fits what we've been trying to teach engineers, just like in general, like you need to like be effective, break down problems, like, and just kind of like you go and seek out that information. And this is just like taking what we already were doing but to a more effective level, you know. So it's not just like, a lot of times they're inventing the wheel just to do it and just to make it very expensive, but you're not, you're actually just, you're improving on the wheel. You know what I mean? It's like, so I think that's just really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, you know, we, as you might imagine, we have many more things that we're looking to build and kind of investing in our own, I guess you call it like AI team that we have. But like philosophically, we're very much aligned with sort of the same, like the thing that we went in on last year when we built the first version of this, of like, we're here to help. We recognize that people come into the product and there's the problems that they come in with are multifaceted. And there's people of varying levels where like some people want zero assistance and that's great. The product is amazing for them. People want some assistance. Some people want a lot of assistance. Some people need a lot of assistance early in their journeys and then they back off of that. Some people want assistance like in the weeds of when they're actually debugging stuff. And we are in a position to be able to help with that to varying degrees. Like if you are not in the middle of an incident, but you have Honeycomb open and you're curious about something, but you're like, huh, my data there's maybe like 100 different questions that I could ask of this data, but I'm not even sure what those 100 questions necessarily are. Or like, are there like even categories of analysis that I could do? Well, great. There's things that we can probably even suggest. Well, based off of the shape of this data here, it looks like, you know, we think there might be these kinds of hypotheses that you could go and test. Do you want to explore some more?
That's my favorite part of AI, just being able to get unstuck. You don't want it to write everything for you, but you just want to know, like, when you're having that brain moment that you like are just like deer in the headlights, it gets you to like move forward.
Yeah. Yeah. Unstick you a little bit and fundamentally encourage curiosity. Because if we get you to dig deeper, get more curious, ask more questions, get more assistance that way, that makes you like, frankly, a better user of Honeycomb. It's really good for our business. If people like, there's like a direct line that you can draw between how many users in an organization that has purchased Honeycomb are like actively engaging with the product and how likely that organization is to want to purchase more Honeycomb, re-up their contract, maybe buy even a whole lot more. And it's like, all right, cool. Like we managed to make it such that our business aligns on encouraging people to be more creative. And I'm like, great, this is perfect.
But that also makes you better at building stuff too. Like, it's not just a reason for you to keep using Honeycomb, but it's just a fundamental thing of being a good builder of things, you know? And just like another thing that, because you're making people more efficient in ways of being able to give them suggestions and give them ways to debug, you're also like, you know, when you're an engineer, you're building something or you're trying to diagnose something, you're so pressed for time that you need to get something back up, you're kind of panicked. So when you take a lot of that panic away, or you give people more time back, they have more time to be curious and more time to do other things, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
How long have you worked at Honeycomb?
3.5 years, almost on the dot, actually.
So. You did all that in 3.5 years? Do you sleep? Like,
I do.
How much coffee do you drink?
I don't, not a whole lot, but I do roast my own coffee.
So you have very strong coffee and like,
it's strong. And that's something like in the coffee roasting community, because of course there's a community for this. People really, really nerd out on it. It's amazing. There's all of these like curves that you can draw about like different like dimensions of the coffee, and you can optimize for like a particular aspect of it, depending on like how you roast it, when you roast it, how much you let it degas, or as I call them, bean farts, degas its CO2. And yeah,
I love that you're nerding out about coffee the same way that you nerd out about like technology.
Hell yeah, it's great.
Well, yeah, so Philip, will Honeycomb help me with my computer crash?
I'm afraid not, no. Different
like, this is not my job.
I'm very sad that I missed a good portion of your conversation. And
I got to hog Philip. It was fire. I loved it. Like,
I'm happy for you.
We had a good time.
Thankfully, I have a backup iPad right now. So, but anyway.
What does the iPad run on? What kind of hardware is that iPad?
It is Hopes and Dreams.
It's Mac. You're welcome. And your Linux is down. Okay, keep going.
Which is also why I could not come into this room for like 15 minutes because the iPad wouldn't let me in. So anyway, but yes, actually, my computer did fully crash. And I don't know if that's hardware or not, because it just locked up and will not boot again. So we will be troubleshooting some things later today. But Philip, thank you for coming on the show. Thank you for explain to all of us. We found you on Blue Sky. You had a thread about your AI infrastructure. So if people want to follow you, I'm assuming Blue Sky is the place to find you and interact.
It is a great place. I'm posting there a whole lot. Definitely not on Elon's site anymore. So I try to post as much like interesting technical stuff as I can out there. Occasionally there'll be a fun post, but
I was going to say, tell me their posts and memes and like just shade there. Cause like, I've seen the faces that you made in the last hour, and I know good things go on in there. Like, good things go on in that brain.
there's going to be a good one. I actually have a blog post I'm going to write soon that's going to be called Maybe You Don't Need a Vector Database.
Did you see that? Did you see his face? That was like the cutest, nerdy, like, just, it's going to be so good. I'm so excited.
I'm going to read that one. That sounds good.
I didn't think I could be excited about vector, but like, here we are.
You kind of don't need a vector database for a lot of stuff.
You both do the eyebrow right before you say something shady, and it's the best. Like, you both, it just, there's one eyebrow that just goes up. And like, I already know that like, this is going to be good. Like, Philip, are you going to come back when we have our new podcast? Cause like, you got to come back.
Yeah, absolutely. Very happy to do it.
And I can finally have a full conversation with you, hopefully.
I'm going to hog all of that one, too. It's okay.
You're the one DDoSing my computer. That's why I went down. I know.
I had questions, okay? Like,
Justin, get out of here. So, all right. Well, thank you so much, Philip, again, for coming on. Thank you, everyone, for listening. We will have one more episode after this. So if you haven't already, go find us at fafo.fm. And we will have feeds and website stuff there for the new podcast, but and also check out Honeycomb. I was like, I've been a fan of what y'all been doing for quite a while. So
OpenTel is baller. Like, it's actually AI that is helpful. Go check that out, dude. I'm gonna check it out. Also, you can all find us all on Blue Sky. So if you can't find the podcast, find us on Blue Sky and we'll tell you where to go.
The podcast is on Blue Sky too, because the domains work there, which is awesome. So it's at FAFOFM. So we're good.
But I feel like it's always good that like people know where to find us just in case they forget the podcast name, because we all know that we're loud and there.
Yeah. Gotcha. Like, right. Thanks, everyone. We'll talk to you later.
Bye, guys. 3, 2, 1.
Thanks for listening to Ship It with Justin Garrison and Autumn Nash. If you haven't checked out our Changelog newsletter, do yourself a favor and head to changelog.com/news. There you'll find 29 reasons, yes, 29 reasons why you should subscribe. I'll tell you reason number 17. You might actually start looking forward to Mondays.
Sounds like somebody's got a case of the Mondays.
28 more reasons are waiting for you at changelog.com/news. Thanks again to our partners at Fly.io. Over 3 million apps have launched on Fly, and you can too in 5 minutes or less. Learn more at Fly.io. And thanks, of course, to our Beat Freak in Residence. We couldn't bump the best beats in the biz without Breakmaster Cylinder. That's all for now, but come back next week when we continue discussing everything that happens after Git Push.